Welcome to Crosscut Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The beginning of the end or the end of the beginning? How should we understand Israel's strike on Iran? Also, is the West opening new fronts against Russia in Moldova and Georgia? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli, in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we cross to Tariq Cyril Amar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's go to George to kick it off. Well, George, the Israel finally did strike against Iran. It was weeks of hype, harsh rhetoric. Obviously, escalation was in the air. And it was well known that depending on the strike, that Iran would return. And so we would go up the escalation ladder. Well, the strike did happen. But what does it mean to you, George?
Well, it's a very good question. It was surprisingly restrained when it comes to Israel. So therefore, we have to try to explain why was Israel so restrained. Well, one obvious possibility is that there is a U.S. election taking place. Israel is watching who's going to prevail in November, and will act accordingly. So I think that was one of the calculations. I think that Israel probably decided to give Biden a break, and it is possible that had Israel acted in a less restrained way, had it actually gone for the oil refineries, maybe there would have been some awkwardness with Washington. We don't yet know. I mean, we'll find out later. As far as what Iran will do, in the short term, probably Iran won't do very much. In the longer term, I think Iran will indeed move towards some kind of a nuclear capability, because this situation is clearly unacceptable to Iran's leaders, whereby it's in the crosshairs of two nuclear powers, Israel and the United States, and it has no means of defending itself.
Yeah, but Tariq, also, as a result, the balance of power has not really changed. I mean, Israel, I agree with George. I think there are political considerations when it comes to Washington, but Israel has to start seriously thinking about what it means to go up the escalation ladder, because it's never had to do this before. It has always been able to attack its neighbors with impunity. Now it's a lot more complicated. Tariq.
Yes, I agree with the last point you made, if I understand it correctly. I would only draw the opposite conclusion from it, as it were. I would say the balance of power has changed.
Okay.
Depends, of course, what your status quo is, right, from which it has changed. I think it has changed in the sense that we have seen Israel restraining itself so as not to be hit too hard too soon by Iran. So one way you can see this is actually also a way in which Iran has proven that it can, to an extent, already deter Israel, right? We don't know what they will do right now or later. I think that's absolutely true. But my reading is that the restraint on the Israeli side, we can explain it to an extent, probably, I think George is right, with considerations that have to do with the USA. But also, I think we shouldn't forget that they also had to calculate the Iranian response, right? And I do think there's an element here in which the baselines have shifted. Since Iran has attacked for the first time, which was a very mild attack, right? And then for the second time, which was a little bit more serious, we have seen that Iran can exert some pressure on Israel. It has also suffered setbacks, that's very clear, because Hezbollah has in many ways taken losses, but not only. But my sense is that Iran has actually proven that its position is stronger than, say, a few years ago. And again, I agree with George that for the Iranian leadership, the key question now is, are we going to act on this now without having a nuclear arsenal, or are we going to acquire nuclear weapons first?
And I think there's almost an inevitability here about that, but that's a subject for another program. George, it's really interesting when we look over the last year, and the question has always been, Why doesn't the Biden administration exert leverage over Israel, since Israel is virtually solely dependent on U.S. arms and diplomatic support? But there is news, opinion, commentary that the Biden administration actually did exert a lot of pressure on Israel on how it would retaliate, which brings up a very interesting and very disturbing question, if it's true. Because if they have leverage over Israel when it comes to broadening the war into the region, why doesn't it apply the same with the genocide in Gaza? I mean, it's a truly disturbing thing to consider. Being they won't exert pressure to stop a genocide, but they will exert pressure to stop the expansion of a war. Your thoughts?
Well, that's an excellent point, because it does look as if, as you say, that the Biden administration did exert a lot of pressure on Israel in this situation. Now, before, it hadn't done anything. So if we look at, well, why has it done it now, then you'd have to think it's in terms of election calculations. They're probably figuring that if Israel were to launch a very serious attack on Iran, including attacks on oil facilities, including maybe even attacks on nuclear facilities, then this would trigger an Iranian response, and this will harm Kamala Harris's re-election process, because we'll say, hey, look, everything is out of control. Ukraine's out of control. The Middle East is out of control. And it'll redound negatively against her. Now, then to answer your question, then, you know, why did they think that? Because that's the way they are. That's what matters to them. They really don't care very much about the plight of Gaza Palestinians. They don't care very much about Lebanon, Hezbollah, anything else. So the only thing they care about is their checkbooks, their jobs, their office holders. And so this is the reason why they, on this occasion, this one occasion, they got quite agitated, because they suddenly thought that this will damage Kamala Harris's election prospects.
Yeah, but Teddy, also, it kind of confirms things that we've talked about in the recent past, is that when it comes to hegemony, the U.S. has a supremacy. But when it comes to the gritty details about how to maintain it, i.e., well, unfortunately, genocide is part of, you know, making the sausage. I mean, you know, the U.S. wants to maintain a hegemonic control in the region, or deny others to have hegemony in the region, which I think is really important. It's a denial policy as well. But, you know, again, we showed this, how it kind of dovetails. As long as it promotes hegemony, Western hegemony, everything else is just fine. Everything else is just kind of an embarrassing detail.
Yeah. I think that's all true. What you have said, what George has said, I would add something, which is what I see and what you're also seeing is that the U.S. administration, the U.S. elite, the bloc, whatever you call them, right? They don't give a damn about a genocide. A genocide, especially of brown people, does not matter to them, right? This is the ethical, the moral dimension, which is incredibly important and horrendous to look at how far they go. It's not totally surprising, but every time they act out like this, it's still shocking, right? But there is a political dimension as well, which is interesting, which is they don't give a damn about the global South. Because, look, even if they are total cynics and monsters, which they are, and they don't care about the murdered children and the murdered civilians, they could still think, yeah, but it looks very bad to most of humanity. So we have to do something about that and adjust to that. And what they've demonstrated over a year now is that they don't even care about this. And I think what this shows is that this American struggle to preserve the empire, the dying empire, as I think, and to preserve hegemony everywhere in the world, is not only brutal, it's always been brutal, it's incredibly short-sighted and stupid now, which makes the U.S. an incredibly dangerous country. They are not restrained either by morality or even by a tiny bit of rationality. Nothing is working anymore, in my view.
Well, George, to add to the pessimism that Tariq just expressed here, when we see a country like Israel slaughtering half the people that are dead in Gaza are children, and this is a genocide against children. Then we see the wanton destruction of whole neighborhoods in Lebanon, in Beirut. But this is a power that has nuclear weapons. I mean, the nightmare scenario of the nuclear age is that, you know, a rogue state or a non-state actor would get their hands on one. But there is a lunatic state that has nuclear weapons committing genocide.
Exactly.
This should be the most terrifying thought in our time, but it's not. George.
No, it isn't, because of the extraordinarily unreserved support that there is for Israel. And therefore, Israel believes that it can get away with everything. Now, you know, one also has to say that the Israel's neighbors have not exactly covered themselves in glory over the past 12 months, because not one Arab state that had diplomatic relations with Israel, not one of them actually even went so far as to break off diplomatic relations. Not one just said, okay, well, that's it. No diplomatic relations. And again, when we come to other powers, where are other powers? You know, where's the BRICS? Where's BRICS coming along? Here is our peace plan. Here is we're proposing a conference. Everybody has to show up for this peace conference. They you know, after all, when it came to Ukraine, they created a phony baloney peace conference on Ukraine. I mean, of course, it didn't achieve anything, but nonetheless, it was at least a good global public relations stunt. You're going to do exactly the same here. We need some kind of a peace conference. So Israel has been able to get away with everything because there haven't been sufficient countervailing forces. And of course, the Americans, well, yeah, of course, America gave a blank check to Israel. It's always given a blank check to Israel.
And it always will if things continue the way they are. George brings up a very, very important point, is the culpability of the entire international system here. And this is a condemnation of it. Certainly coming to an end. What's coming into being is hard to say. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. And we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
Лекутян мечтает сняться в кино, да? Или снять.
Мне просто мама сказала, что я в кино снимаюсь. Когда я картошку копал.
Я в кино начал сниматься на проекте «Тыгын-Таркан». Тут вся республика на это кино работала.
Очень много местного населения было задействовано.
Я получила роль... Хохотушка номер два.
Она дала мне весельчака. Еще весельчак не номер один, а номер два.
Так, может, в этом и есть феномен якутского кино? Что
отчасти, да, может.
То, что мы делаем, становится близко и понятно и другим народам.
Во время съемок было очень много мистического.
В любом якутском фильме, любого жанра, все равно что-то мистическое присутствует. Потому что это часть нашей жизни.
Мы же поклоняемся природе. Против природы Саха не идет.
Камера. Идет.
Мы готовимся к более грандиозному. А это будет новый «Властелин колец».
Well, Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we're discussing some real news. Tadiq, let me go back to you first here. We just had a parliamentary election in Georgia. It was preceding it. It was tight, 50-50. It was the Georgians were presented with a Russian future or a radiant future with the EU and Western values and everything. It was highly propagandized. Reading Western media on it, its coverage was deplorable. I mean, we're all critics of Western media, but reading some of these things just was extraordinarily biased and highly politicized here. But the Georgian people have spoken. The ruling party, Georgian Dream, did well. I think it did better than far more than what the polls said. But of course, the opposition called foul. So we could see something like the Maidan from 2014 in Ukraine. Your thoughts there? Because I want to dovetail it into what we had in recent election, referendum we had in Moldova. Go ahead, Tariq.
You know, the struggle over Georgia, right, has been going on now for at least since 2008, you could say, right? And it's a geopolitical struggle, most of all. It's not a struggle about values. As always, the values are the packaging. And by now, everybody who's halfway intelligent should have caught up to that, right? It's no longer fresh. It's a very old propaganda trick that we are exposed to again. And the reality is that if you look at Georgian Dream, which, you know, I have no stake in Georgian politics at all, but as far as I read up on it, Georgian Dream is hardly actually a pro-Russian party. What Georgian Dream is...
There are no pro-Russian parties in Georgia.
Exactly.
And there are no pro-Russian parties
exactly.
in Georgia.
But that's the problem. What Georgian Dream really stands for is to an extent retain a balance that could actually be very advantageous and healthy for Georgia, where Georgia can work with Russia, with China, not to be forgotten, with which it's building important relationships, and if the West agrees, which is always the problem with the West, it would also be open to working with the West. Because look at the way that the relationship between on one side the US and the EU and Georgia on the other side has recently developed. All the aggressive steps have literally come from the EU, the Commission, and from the American government. There have been personal sanctions. Money has been withheld from the US, from the EU. We've had blatant election interference on the side of the EU, which basically was trying to leverage visa privileges to tell Georgians either you vote Georgian Dream out or you won't get your visa privileges anymore. It was very, very clear what was going on there. Whereas Georgian Dream was at one point retaliating, their rhetoric got sharper in response. But if you look at their fundamental positions, they are ready to work with everyone. And the real problem in the West is, and this was done to Ukraine as well, exactly the same thing in 2013. The real problem is that the West says it's only us. You cannot work with everybody. You must have only us. It's an exclusive relationship. And personally, whatever else happens in Georgia, I'm on the side of those who think it's much better to maintain a balanced relationship in that geopolitical situation, because the other thing that can happen to you is your radiant future is going to be that of Ukraine.
Exactly. And I think that's what so many Georgia, we have August 2008. That is recent memory, George. You know, and I before I forget, the outrageous election fraud in Moldova, where the Russian, the diaspora in Russia was effectively blocked from participating, most likely would have made the difference here. But and even the, all of that electioneering, and it was the result was razor thin. We can leave it at that. But, George, what this is really all about, it's not European values or Euro-Atlantic and all, you know, all that's kind of soft and fuzzy stuff here. This is all the process of inducting Georgia and Moldova into NATO. That's the only thing they care about. The rest of it is just fluff. Go ahead, George.
That's exactly right. I mean, if one remembers the war, the 2008 war in Georgia, it was directly triggered by the Bucharest summit that promised NATO membership to Ukraine and to Georgia. Georgia knew Well, Saakashvili, the president of Georgia at the time, knew that Georgia could not join NATO as long as it had unresolved armed conflicts on its territory. So Saakashvili took it upon himself. He saw that as a signal from NATO that, hey, I can now resolve my problems in Georgia, and then I'll be good to go for membership of NATO. And he was probably given indications by U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that, yeah, go ahead, you know, do it. You know, Russia's preoccupied with lots of other things. This is your moment. So it's no question that this is what the goal is here in Georgia and in Moldova. And of course, there's also the question of opening up another front against Russia, because, you know, if there was to be some kind of a problem again, as in 2008 in South Ossetia or Abkhazia, or if in Moldova there's going to be a problem with Transnistria, that's going to be difficult for Russia. I mean, Russia is very preoccupied with Ukraine. It won't be at all as easy as it was in 2008 to handle that crisis. And NATO knows this. And that's why that's the only value of Georgia and Moldova. These are two poor countries, but they are in a strategic location. Georgia is a very strategic location. I mean, it's the eastern coast of the Black Sea. It's a neighboring Turkey. It neighbors Azerbaijan. Clearly, this is something that's of great value to NATO. So all the rest about values and the LGBTQ rights or the Foreign Agents Registration Act, all that, it's just a lot of hard air. But then going back to your original question, Peter, well, what's going to happen now? Well, we know that the opposition has already cried foul. The media are already pumping oxygen into these claims. I fully expect the EU today to say, absolutely not. This was a completely bogus election. This was stolen. You need to cancel it immediately. And the Georgian president, who was kind of parachuted in, to be the sort of pro-Western president, echo these cries.
The Georgian president, who is a French citizen, correct?
Who is a French citizen who was born and lived all her life in France and took was a member of the French civil service throughout her career, and only upon her retirement did they grab her and dump her into Georgia. This doesn't, you know, doesn't even really speak Georgian, but they dumped her there to make sure that Georgia maintained its pro-Western course.
You know, Tariq, I looked very closely at campaigns in Moldova and Georgia. And you know what? I don't want to, you know, surprise you or anything, but it was about corruption, energy security, inflation. This is what most voters were talking about, okay? You know, the current Moldovan president came in on an anti-corruption platform, but she was running for re-election on, you know, the move to the West. I mean, she abandoned corruption. She abandoned the standard of the energy crisis that Moldova was. They created it themselves. They wanted to have spot market prices for oil and gas. And no, we don't do that. You know, no long-term contracts with the Russians. You have to use spot. Well, then when the prices go up, a poor country is poor. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's the way, you know, the way these campaigns were run is that they will slip back into Russia's hands. Well, if you look at both of them, Moldovans, they actually, you know, border Ukraine. A lot of them don't want that to happen to them. The Georgians already know what can happen in 2008. They want to be restrained as well. And the win-win approach that you described earlier, I think that's what most people want. But the mandarins in Brussels and in Washington say no, just exactly what you say, only us. Go ahead, Tariq.
You know, I wonder also what will happen next in both cases, right? And of course, I can only guess and speculate. But concerning Georgia, from the little I know and have observed recently, my sense is that if there is an attempt by the EU, by the West, to parachute in the usual people, Martin Roth and so on, and start a color revolution again, I think they will fail in Georgia. And I think that because they failed to topple the transparency law. And they pulled out all the stops then. I mean, if you look at the demonstrations against the transparency law, those could easily have been turned into a color revolution scenario. And I think they would have been turned into that if only they would have been able to do that. And I think they have tested their limits already. And in the Georgian case, my sense is the EU and the West can try once again, as they like to do in Georgia and other places, but I think they'd fail. Now, the Moldovan case, I think, is a bit more complicated, partly because of geographical location, and partly because it seems to be that the incumbent, after all, is already on the side of the West, as it were. So we're starting from a different position, right? It might be possible for the EU to force, impose its policy on Moldova. Unfortunately, I don't think this is good for Moldova. But my sense is they won't be able to do it in Georgia, and it's going to turn into another EU failure that they will then cover up, of course. Of course, the underlying problem is that every time these attempts are made, whether they fail or, in quotation marks, succeed for the West, right? Whether they fail or succeed in bringing down governments they don't like and in realigning the geopolitics of sovereign nations, every time they do a lot of damage. In all of these scenarios, all of these societies suffer a lot of damage. And what we really need to see is that at some point, somebody forces the West to stop trying. Not just to try and fail, but to stop trying.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point, because, George, I just don't think it's in their DNA. I think that they have such a myopic view. They truly believe it's about democracy, because NATO and democracy are the same thing, I mean, which is absurd. But I think in their mind, that's why I think this is very dangerous. And these people are not very nuanced at the end of the day, okay?
No.
When in doubt, violence. This is what's going to happen.
No, I agree with you, Peter. I mean, they're not capable of changing course. So that's why we can already outline exactly what they're going to do. And I think Tarik may be right that that they will fail, that even if they start triggering violence, you know, we'll have the usual burnt buildings, burnt cars, and then the media will regale us with terrifying stories of police brutality. And then we'll hear from Antony Blinken about peaceful demonstrators and the Georgian really needs to rerun this election. All of that, probably the ruling government will prevail. Now, there was a question of then with Moldova, because of course we still have another round to go next week. And we, you know, Maia Sandu, and then again, since we already know that what happened a week ago was clearly a stolen election, it will be kind of interesting again whether they're going to try and steal it again in the second round.
Maybe a topic for next week's program here, but I think all three of us agree. Buckle up and brace for impact. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Well, I want to thank my guests in Istanbul and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RTC. See you next time. And remember, cross that rules. We'll be right back.